Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 1986, and the presenter was Michael Parkinson.
Our castaway today is one of the legendary figures of rock and roll. In a notoriously fickle industry, he survived all the changes to remain a star for nearly 20 years. Also, he's the only chairman of Watford Football Club to have sold 80 million records. He is, of course, Elton John. Let's go right back to the very beginning. When did you first start taking piano lessons?
Well, I first started taking lessons when I was about 6 or 7. I can't remember exactly, but I originally started playing piano by ear, because I grew up being looked after by my grandmother and mother, because my father was in the Air Force. And I was born in my grandmother's house in Pinner Green in Middlesex. And we always had a piano in the house because my auntie used to play. And so when I was about 5 or 6, my parents thought it might be a good idea that I should have some formal education in music, which, of course, I didn't particularly like. But I was very lucky enough, they sent me to a local woman called Mrs. Jones in Pinner, whose husband was a very good classical musician as well. And she was lovely, and so that was a good start. And I got an okay. I could read okay, but I was never that much interested, actually, in becoming a classical musician, because ever since I can remember, I've always wanted to do something in music, but popular music. Winifred Atwell was my first influence, and I mean, her other piano, I used to sit as a kid and watch her on the television and see her move over to the other piano. I was so impressed. So I could rattle off all her stuff, and then Ross Conway, I can still play side saddle to this day.
Right, let's have a first musical choice for our desert island.
I went to Barbados in 1976, and I'd been really successful from 1970 to 76 in America and all over the world. And I was really quite shattered, physically and mentally. And I'd never really had a long holiday in the West Indies at all. And we went to Barbados, and Bernie Taupin, my lyric writer, and myself, we had 2 houses on the beach. You know, they have certain records that you remember. And there was a Pink Floyd album called Wish You Were Here. And I always remember one day, we were sitting on the beach, and this lady came down in tears and said, "Listen, my son's dying of cancer. Can he come down and say hello to you?" And we said, "Of course, bring him down for tea." Well, they brought him down for tea. They carried him down for tea. And he was like, it was just skin and bone. There was nothing of him. He came down every day. And at that particular time, the track from this album that we used to play was Shine On You Crazy Diamond. And one night at sunset, we all held hands, put the track on. I'm not particularly religious or anything, but we said, OK, let's just hope he gets better. And that was it. And then 3 years later, I was playing in Philadelphia. There was a knock on my door. No, Washington, D.C. A knock on my hotel door, and this guy said, "Hi, it's Steve." And I said, "Yes, can I help you?" And it was the same boy who was muscular, looked like a Sylvester Stallone sort of person, completely healthy. And yet, if you'd have seen this boy, you know, he was literally 3 months to live. So I always remember this track, and it's a wonderful track, and it brings back happy memories.
Pink Floyd and Shine On Your Crazy Diamond. Elton, were you bright academically as a child?
Yes, I was pretty much so. But by the time I'd reached 13, I actually knew that I wanted to do something in music. And so I didn't really bother that much. And I was always a child that could just about do enough works to scrape through an O-level or to scrape through maybe an A-level. In fact, I didn't stay long enough to take my A-levels, but I got 5 O-levels. It was the same with music lessons. When I was at Pinner County, I won a junior exhibitionist scholarship to the Royal Academy, which meant that you went to school Monday to Friday, and you went to the Academy Saturday, and you did your homework Sunday. So I was very, very much anti the Royal Academy, the fact that I had no leisure time. No, I couldn't play football or anything like that. So I went there, and I used to enjoy the choir. But I sometimes, mostly at the end of it, I used to play truant. I used to go up to Baker Street and sit on the Circle Line for 3 hours, then come home.
So you left school then before you'd really fulfilled all your academic potential. Mm. What was your first job?
As I say, I was at Pinner County, and I was about 2 months away from my A-levels, of which I had no chance of really passing. My cousin was a footballer, Roy Dwight, and he played for Nottingham Forest. And he knew this man called Pat Sherlock, who worked in Denmark Street in London at Mills Music Publishing. And even though I was in a little band then, I just wanted to enter music, but I didn't know how to get my foot in the door. And I was offered a job as a tea boy and sort of general runaround. I forget what wages for, but I mean, I was really excited to get the chance. And I went to see my headmaster, Mr. Westgate Smith, who I was always quite afraid of, a very strict man. And I was terribly afraid, knocked on his door, and he said, "Are you definitely sure this is what you want to do?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, you have my blessing." And I couldn't believe it, because I thought he was going to say no, and he was going to make me stay and do the examinations. I thought that was a great decision on his part, and a very, very lucky decision on my part, because there I tripped off to Mills Music and started packing up parcels, taking the tea and everything like that. And that was a very happy time. I think I was there for about a year, and I really loved it.
Let's now have the second choice of music, Elton, for your desert island.
Well, I've always loved black music, good soul singers, R&B singers. And Nina Simone is one of my favourite singers of all time, and this is an old record of hers, but the classic, classic record, I Put a Spell on You.
I put a spell on you. Cause you're mine. Do, 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 do. You better stop the things you do.
Nina Simone, I Put a Spell on You. Elton, about this time, did you have any ambitions to be a songwriter?
No. I was in a little band, local band, called Bluesology, and after about a year at Mills Music, we had the chance to turn professional, and we did, backing a lot of R&B singers from America, rhythm and blues singers, black singers. But really, I was just an adequate organist. I was never had ambitions to write songs. When Bluesology subsequently made two records for Philips Records, I wrote the songs, but they were awful. One was called Mr. Frantic, and the first one was called Come Back Baby. Both, I think, were published by Mills Music, and one can tell by the title that they weren't exactly works of art. And I've never been a lyric writer. I've always been a melody man, so those records consisted of Come Back Baby 16 times and a version in Chinese. And so they weren't very good. And the reason I left my band, we ended up backing Long John Baldry when he had his big hit Let the Heartaches Begin, and we started to play cabaret. And I'm afraid cabaret is probably the one thing I refuse ever to play, because it's such a nightmare for someone to play music and while people are not really interested. And so I left the band and I thought, what can I do? And I thought, well, maybe I can be a songwriter. I never used to sing, and I never used to be that good an organist to get another job. But I knew, as a musician, you can always get a job somewhere playing to people. It's a pub or something. So the breadline isn't too important. It's just that the ethics involved. So I answered an advertisement in the New Musical Express. It was from Liberty Records. And they said, we're looking for new talent, songwriters and everything like that. So I sent a letter. And through great quirks of fate, got introduced by Bernie Taupin.
When you started up with Bernie Taupin in the early 70s and you wrote those wonderful hits, which are now standards, of course, like Rocket Man and Yellow Brick Road, they're all written in Pinner, were they?
No. Originally, see, when I met Bernie, the first two or three years when we were signed to our publishers, we were told to write songs for other people. In fact, the late 60s was the last sort of great period when you had sort of songwriters turning out songs for other people. And then the age of the singer-songwriter came in and they kept them all for themselves. So initially we had to write two or three songs a week for other people like Cilla Black or Tom Jones. And they were so bad, nobody ever recorded them, except that when Lulu did the Eurovision Song Contest, we got one into the last six of the British Heat. And it came sixth. We didn't really have any great success until, 1970.
Let's now take your third record.
I said earlier that about classical music, and when I was at the Academy, I didn't particularly enjoy it that much, except as a pianist, you like to play Chopin, because it's just beautiful. But consequently, I love English sort of classical music, and I'm a great Elgar and Vaughan Williams fan. And the Enigma variations I take everywhere in the world. If I go somewhere, I've always got a cassette of the Nimrod variations. And I just like to sit there, especially in the West Indies, I record a lot in the West Indies, and sit there at sunset and play with headphones on and just look out to sea. And I start crying and think, like, I'm terribly emotional. Oh. And so this is the Enigma variation, this is Nimrod.
Thank you. Nimrod from the Enigma Variations. Elton, did you always want to be a star?
No, this was, again, going back to when I left the band Bluesology and started writing songs. When we started writing songs for other people, as I say, nobody wanted to record them because they weren't particularly good. And in the organisation, a man called Steve Brown arrived and took care of Bernie and I, sort of took us under his wing, and had the actual guts to go into Dick James and say, well, listen, they're not very good at what you want them to do, but they are writing songs that they like, and I think they have a much better future. And Dick, to all his credit, said, OK, you look after them. And he did, Steve Brown, and I had to make the demos of the records, so I had to sing. And then he made me sort of make records, which I didn't ever think I would do. First record I really made was I've Been Loving You, but that doesn't count, seeing as I wrote the lyrics. First record that really got me noticed was a record called Lady Samantha. And when I say noticed, it got a lot of airplay on the BBC. And then, because in those days, to sell records, you had to go out and play live. And the last thing I wanted to do after leaving the band was go back on the road.
Why?
Because I'd been on the road for 3 years with the band, and I found it completely unglamorous. And still, to this day, I don't like travelling at all. It's just really boring. But I got together with two musicians called Nigel Olsen and Dee Murray. Nigel played drums and Dee played bass. And I started to play in England and get a reputation. And that helped me a great deal, because performing is one of the things that helps an artist sort of carry on his longevity as an artist. I mean, you get the experience to play live, and you look at any of the big acts that are around now, most of them are good live artists. And once I started, I really enjoyed it, because I'd never been a front man before. I'd just been a piano player. So, in fact, I was in charge.
You're not naturally extrovert, are you?
I wasn't then, no.
No,
but I became an extrovert, because in my teenage years, I found that I was more or less overweight quite a bit. I had strict upbringing, and I was not really allowed to have a drop-handlebar bike or a pair of hush puppies. Ah, can you believe it? I missed day
now
and
we're
age.
Going to the
can
real
you believe
truth,
now? This is the real problem with me. You see, I was never allowed to have a drop-handlebar bike. My success happened in my 20s, and I lived my teenage years through my 20s. I could do exactly what I wanted to do for the first time in my life. And consequently, if I wanted to wear an outrageous piece of clothing, I did. But again, that wasn't planned. I was just enjoying myself. And I'm very fortunate, because the way I happened on a large scale, I went to America and played at the Troubadour Club in 1970 when the Elton John album was released. And it was a revolutionary album as far as that strings had never been used like that on an album before. They'd been used in funky arrangements. They were done by a man called Paul Buckmaster. And it revolutionised string writing and records as far as pop music concerned. And it was a very well-produced album. It was the first album I ever did with Gus Dudgeon, who I subsequently did 17 albums and have done my recent album with him as well. And I went to America and played at a small club called the Troubadour Club. And it was MCA Records who I was recording for, hyped, you know, it was full of 300 people from the business. Mm. But they'd heard the album. Neil Diamond introduced me on the stage, which was a tremendous thing for him to do, because he liked the record. And they thought, because the Elton John album cover was very dark and doomy, that I was going to come out and look like Randy Newman. In fact, I came out with shorts on and flying boots and Mickey Mouse ears and played rock and roll. They went, what is this? And I had a review from Robert Hilburn in the Los Angeles Times and the music critic. It was a full-page review. And it broke me in America when I was in front of 300 people who weren't even paid to come and see me. So it was a kind of fluke.
What's been your favourite uniform over the years?
I've got them all here, actually, still. I've never thrown anything away. And I've got all my old stage clothes. I go and look at them and I think, my God, I'm in the Muppet, doing the Muppet Show a few years ago. Luckily, I was quite slim then as well, because I tend to put on weight. They said, we want all your old costumes. And I just said, no, I'm not going to wear them again. So I had to go through them all. And some of them were so heavy, and I used to wear them for 3 hours. And there was one called the Giant Chicken Outfit, which is like a torso thing with just all chicken feathers. I remember there was an outfit that was all black, but it had black elastic on it and coloured fluorescent balls that shine under white light. And I had a huge headdress with spikes coming up, so that when I came on, all you could see were these balls on this headdress, because I used to come in black, and I used to sort of be moving, and you see all these coloured balls going like this way, and people think, what is this? And a load of old balls, yeah. and the hats. You know, I used to open with a song called Funeral Friend, Love Lies Bleeding, which is quite long. And by the time I finished, I had these hats on, and also a pair of glasses. There was one electric pair of glasses, the first, I think, that I can remember anyone using on stage. But they were so heavy that my nose is quite small. So at the end of the song, I was singing like this. And my ears were down here. Quite honestly, I just considered them normal things at the time. But looking back at it, I must have been out of my mind.
You're a colourful masochist, I think.
Probably.
Right, let's have another choice of record, the fourth record.
I originally chose 8 of the saddest pieces of music. I thought, no, I've really got to choose some up-tempo ones. And I do love good rock and roll music. This is the Rolling Stones. They write great rock and roll songs. This is called Let It Rock, and it's just me on the beach going crazy after getting up from Nimrod.
Rolling Stones and Let It Rock. Elton, can I talk a little bit now about soccer? Because I know it's one of the great passions of your life.
Yes, I always supported Watford Football Club as a child, even though my cousin, Roy Dwight, who I mentioned earlier, initially played for Fulham, and I can remember going and sitting on the touchline at Craven Cottage and seeing Johnny Haynes, Toss Chamberlain and people like that, which was a great experience. And then he went to Forest and scored the first goal in the 59 Cup final. But I was always a Watford supporter. I remember standing on the terraces with my dad. I was doing a musical interview in New Musical Express in the early 70s with a little girl called Julie Webb. And she said, "You're a Watford supporter, I live in Watford, why don't you approach them and do a concert?" And this was at the time when I was wearing, you know, 8-inch high-heeled shoes. I, you know, more platforms than anyone ever dared. And then I saw a pop group on television with 6 inches, I went for 8. And I had pink hair. So I approached the board of directors, and this is the point I'm trying to make. When I've had the initial meeting with them, although they must have probably laughed their heads off when I walked out the door, the thing that got me interested in Watford Club was the people. Just yeah. More than the football, because I hadn't seen them actually yet. But they treated me so much more differently than people in my business would. I mean, there was, for example, the washing lady, Molly, who was a lovely lady, used to say to me, "Don't like your new record. Why don't you make something like Daniel again?" And she, but then it was, you know, there's no holds barred. They were very, very protective of me and very, very loving. And I remember I turned up one Boxing Day for a Luton game, and it was a time when I was drinking very heavily. I wasn't particularly very happy. I knew I was in a state, and Graham Taylor said, "I want to see you for lunch." And I thought, I know what he was going to say. He's going to give me a lecture. So I went to his house for lunch. You know, he was very nice. He said, "Here you are. Put a bottle of brandy on the table." He said, "Have that. That's what you want, isn't it?" I needed someone to lecture me. And they've always done that. I never can get one over. I can maybe get one over on some people because of who I am. But with Watford, they won't. They'll tell you in some sort of way that, you know, you're being a fool.
What's pulled you back before that as well? Because, I mean, you know, you've been 20 years in this loony business.
Yes.
And you've survived. I mean, here you are today. I mean, you're looking good. You're happy. You're enjoying yourself. There must have been times, of course, when you went to the brink. I mean, most people do in that situation.
Well, I think, yes. In 6 years, I made, God knows, about 17 albums. And I made separate singles as well. And I did tours. And those 6 years, I worked and worked away because I couldn't believe initially it was happening to me. I'm glad I didn't want to become a singer. And I'm glad I didn't ever envisage being a star because it really happened so quickly and so stupidly. And I was suddenly, from nowhere, I was there. And I just couldn't believe it. I was in the same room as George Harrison and people like that. And I really, really enjoyed it. And I think that was the key to success. After 6 years, I'd burnt myself out musically. And indeed, I hadn't had much time for myself in my private life. And so I just, for 2 years, I said, I've got to stop. Because I was just, I was going on stage. I love performing. But if you go on stage and you perform and you suddenly start thinking, well, what time's the plane tomorrow? What am I going to wear? And you're halfway through a song and then you panic, think, oh, what's the next word? Then it's time for you to stop because you can't cheat on a live performance. You can cheat when you make a record because you can go over and over and over and do it again. Mm. But with a live performance, you can't cheat. And I think that's why people like live performances. But playing live, I was very bored with playing live. And so I thought, I've got to stop for 2 years. But the ego is such that you think, well, someone's going to take over my crown. In fact, my crown had already slipped. You can only have the crown for 2 years tops, probably. And then, you know, there are always bridges to cross. And as a musician, I think there's always other fields to conquer. But you just have to refresh yourself. You have to stop and build up your passion again. And luckily enough, I think you create your own luck. When I did that, I moved into this house in Windsor, which is a very big house, with big gates at the end of it. And I thought, well, what am I going to do here? Sit here for 2 years? And I was already a director of Watford Football Club. And because I'd made that decision, the former chairman, the late chairman, said, why don't you become chairman? And I thought, my God, I never thought of becoming chairman. And I accepted. And so that gave me another thing to do. And if I hadn't have had that, I don't know what would have happened to me.
And, of course, having talked about Watford Football Club, this next record is just a reminder of football generally, isn't it? It's
yes,
the anthem.
The success at Watford Football Club happened so quick. You know, we got from the fourth to the first and into the cup final within about 7 years. The reason we did it is because we worked as a team of people, Graham Taylor, the manager, Eddie Plumley, Bertie Mee, the people that work there, and the team and the people. There's great discipline there from the manager. I never interfere. The board of directors never interferes with managerial decisions or anything because Graham is a one-off person. He really is. He got that club going more than I. I provided the money and the capital, and I provided, I think, a lot of his enthusiasm and a helping hand. But he did a hell of a lot of work. Graham thought it might take 5 years to get to the second, and we got there much quicker. And the spirit within the club has always, as I said, been very dear to me. When we got to the cup final, it was the first cup final for a long time that I'd heard a bye with me without anybody singing obscenities over it. Mm. And Everton, it was kind of weird. And that day, Everton won it, and I wasn't I was disappointed. But I know next time I'd love to win it. I wouldn't want to lose next time. But just to stand there in the Royal Box and seeing 25,000 of our supporters at one end and going on the pitch. You know, it was just wonderful. I think, and I can honestly say that, apart from my getting married, that's probably the happiest day of my life.
Bye With Me, which is, of course, I suppose, the anthem, isn't it, of soccer?
Yeah, it's a lovely song. Lovely hymn.
You've, Elton, had this capacity always to enjoy your success. I mean, a lot of people in your business don't seem to enjoy it, do they?
They don't seem to enjoy it, no. I only speak for myself, and I say that I really have enjoyed it. And I've always... Everywhere I go, I try and pick up a memento somewhere or where I've been. I'm a terrible hoarder. As I say, I've never thrown any stage clothes away. We've had the floors reinforced here. No, that's not serious. But, I mean, if a fan sends me something, I find it very hard. I usually keep it.
Well, also, too, I mean, you mentioned there about buying things when you're on tour. I mean, outside here, you're surrounded by huge Chinese lions.
Yeah, well, I went to China with a football club, and I saw these lions. We went to a sort of antique dealer. We got this woman who was the mother of our interpreter, who was a very, very... an English woman or an American lady, I can't remember which. But anyway, she took us to this sort of antique wholesalers. And I bought these lions. They had to make them. They're 6 tons each. And you know, I don't think I bought a tram in Melbourne in Australia. Only
tram.
I could buy a tram in Melbourne. And you buy the tram and you think, well, this is a wonderful piece of work. Because I love old... When I say old things, I love good, you know, craftsmanship. Because I buy it. And then I think, oh, how am I going to get it back? And then how am I going to get it back? How do I get it from the docks to here? That was the main thing. I mean, it was put on a boat from Australia to Southampton. And then when it was from Southampton, we had two alternatives to get it up by road, which meant that one would have to go across the field over there and take my hedge down but close the roads for about 2 days, which I'm afraid the locals wouldn't particularly like, or fly it in by two Chinook helicopters, which was the first alternative. But, I mean, we live so near to the airport, as you probably hear on some of these, you know, planes going over all the time. I could see the Daily Mirror headline, Jumbo in mid-air collision with tram, you know. So we decided we decided not to do that. And eventually we had to bring it out. But, I mean, I tend to go and say, oh, yes, I'll have that. It's wonderful. And the consequences involved tend to be a little farcical. But, no, I've always bought stuff. I've always, as a child, and people say, well, you know, you're into material things. But as a child, I never had a brother and sister or anything. I never had, really, somebody regular to play with or anything like that. And don't say art. But, I mean, I grew up with inanimate objects. And so I always treated things very well. I always looked after things, books and stuff like that. And so I suppose that's carried on. But I do collect things, especially things that are old, and 20s and 30s and 40s, or even 50s, especially Bentley cars and designs and actual workmanship. And, yes, I do collect them because I think they should be preserved.
Let's now have another choice of record.
This one is an extraordinary piece of music by a jazz musician called Thelonious Monk, who has, of all the jazz musicians, has the most wonderful sense of humour in his music. And this is from an album, a double album, that was actually a compilation album of other people playing his tracks that was released a couple of years ago. And it's a track called Mysteriosa, performed by Carla Bley with an array of great musicians, including a piano solo, which I think, for me, is one of the most beautiful piano solos I've ever heard because it's got ferocity, touch. It's just incredible. It's by a guy called Kenny Kirkland playing the piano, who now plays with Sting. This always cheers me up and makes me think, well, perhaps one day I'll be able to play like that.
Carla Bley and Misterioso. Elton, the next record up I know is a John Lennon record. I also happen to know that you were a friend and a great admirer of the late John Lennon. First of all, why the admiration? What particularly about John was it that you liked?
Well, obviously his music, but the real admiration stemmed from the fact that when I met him in the mid-70s, I used to wear dark glasses, and I used to use them as a real sort of shield because I was very shy. And you think, my God, he gets to go on stage and wear all those things. How could he be shy? But I was, the other side of me, and still is to a certain extent, very shy. And John had the wonderful ability to go into a room full of people that he didn't know or had nothing to do with music and could come from any background in the world and be nice to everybody and just take a general interest and be genuine about it. And I thought, oh, my God, I wish I could be like that. And I really knew him well for a year. And then he met Yoko and got married, and they had Sean. And I sort of left him alone. You don't have to be good friends with someone and see them all the time. He was just so nice to people. I mean, he could be crazy and very mean, but he was never that to me. I never really saw that side of him. For example, in New York, he would take my mum and dad out for dinner, or he would take my band to the airport. There was something about him which was incredibly kind. I've only ever saw his kindness. I never really saw him being nasty or anything.
And why this particular record that you've chosen?
Well, I didn't want to sit there and hear one of his songs because they were all such personal songs of his, and the lyrics were very, very personal. So I thought, right, I'm going to choose a Lennon track of someone else's. So this is Stand By Me.
No, I won't be afraid. No, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by me.
Stand By Me and John Lennon. Elton, you once said, I can't see myself playing rock and roll when I'm 35. Well, you're over 35 now and you're still playing rock and roll.
Yes.
So, why?
A good question. I still like performing, that's why. And I really haven't taken the time off in my life as a musician to really try and do the important things I want to do, because they really, it's not the right time to do that. I think you really know that the time, things fall into place eventually. And when I was making the new album this year, Ice on Fire, I met some musicians that I'd never played with before, English musicians. And I thought, my God, I've really got to go out and play with these people after only 9 months ago saying I can't physically go on the road again. Because I was just, it's the same as 1976, I was felt burnt out. But you get a new injection of other people's ideas. And I started the British tour last year, and I really had such a great time. I mean, now I'm going on to Europe and America, because it's a different injection of life and different people. But there are things which I want to do. I want to make an instrumental album. I want to do the musical, which we are working on.
To do a musical?
Yes, but I only want to write one. I'm not a great fan of musicals that are written today, but I would love to write one of the caliber of West Side Story, which to me is the finest musical ever written, because it's just, you know, it's faultless. But that will take time. It'll take a couple of years, and also we'll have to... A, you've got to have a good subject matter, and B, you have to have someone who helped you with it, because I'd like to put it on stage first rather than film it. But I'm 39, and there's plenty of time left to do that, but it's something I would like to do, just to show everybody else that everything else has been written more or less ever since. It's quite mediocre.
Final record.
Final record. Well, I tried to choose the records because of the people involved or because they had some special effect or memory that I had in my life. And this, I've chosen a record by Wham, and people are going to say, oh, my God...
Well, that was my reaction, first of all.
I just happen to love this record, Wake Me Up Before I Go-Go, because it sounds like an old Motown record, and all those wonderful old Motown records by the Supremes, the Four Tops, Marvin Gaye. I've been in the studio time and time again trying to recreate a Motown sound and get that sound. You can't do it. And when I first heard this record, I didn't know it was George singing. I thought it was an old Motown, or someone, the nearest they'd come. And the bass player, and the musicianship on this record is quite astonishing. The bass player, Dion Estes, on this record, who I got to play on my new record, because I'd heard this record. So to hell with everybody else. George Michael will be around a long time. This is Wake Me Up Before I Go. Come on, baby, let's not fight. We'll go dancing. Everything will be all right. Wake me up before you go, go. Don't leave me hanging on like a yo-yo. Wake me up before you go, go. I don't want to miss it when you hear that. Wake me up before you go, go. Because I'm not planning on going solo. Wake me up before you go, go.
That was Wham and Wake Me Up Before You Go Go. Elton, now we've come to the choice of things on this desert island. What, first of all, would be the book that you would want on the island? You've already got the Bible and the works of Shakespeare.
Well, I probably wouldn't have taken those either, but don't want to stir up a hornet's nest. There are I've got one book, so I'm going to choose a novel. I nearly took The Art of Rubinstein autobiography because it's so wonderful, but I've chosen a novel by Anne Rice called Interview with a Vampire, which lets your imagination run riot. It's a story of a vampire who does an interview, present-day interview, with a man from Rolling Stone and just tells about his life. In fact, as a vehicle, it would be the ideal thing to write a musical to. Unfortunately, the rights have been sold, but it would be a great vehicle for sort of writing 300 years of music. You could start off with classical music and come right up to date. It's a wonderful book, and I don't really like novels very much. I've always been an autobiography person.
But now, what about the one record? They've got to assume that seven records have been wiped off by
wiped
out.
Yeah.
Which one?
Enigma Variations.
Really?
Yes, because of England and because it's just the most wonderful piece of music.
And finally, the one luxury object you're allowed on the island.
Because I'd still be the lost chairman of Watford Football Club, I'd have to take a telephone and find out for the score. But I wouldn't know the matches, and I didn't know whether they'd be playing away or at home. And I wouldn't know the time difference, but I'm sure I could work that out eventually. So I'd have to keep in touch with the club, obviously.
So solar-powered telephone.
A solar-powered telephone, yes. So I could keep up on the gossip, Gaffan, I'm saying, well, you don't know where I am, I'm still alive, but then who's doing what to who and what's happening? Because everybody likes a good gossip. So, yes, I think a telephone.
Elton John, thank you very much indeed. By the way, would you play us out?
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.